Joe Biden says recent Supreme Court rulings on the Second Amendment are dangerous. Hunter Biden is relying on those cases to beat his gun rap. What's going on here? Also, will young voters love President Biden because he's going after Ticketmaster while forgiving their student loans? And is it undemocratic for California voters to get to vote on the tax increases that they're going to pay? We will discuss all this and more in today's episode of Independent Outlook. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to Independent Outlook, where we try to offer an independent take on the issues of the day. As always, I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Philip Magnus, who is the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy here at Independent. Welcome, Phil.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Also, my perennial partner in crime, Williamson Evers. Hello, Bill Evers.
How are you, sir?
Great. Bill Evers, of course, is a polymath and the director of our Center on Educational Excellence. So, gentlemen, to begin this conversation, I am wondering about the oddity of this gun indictment against Hunter Biden, son of President Joe Biden, who was apparently an addict at the time when he signed a federal form enabling him to purchase a gun. And there is a law that says you can't be an addict or something like that. And so Hunter Biden's attorney has already announced he's going to be relying upon the Bruin case, recently written out by the U.S. Supreme Court, written by Clarence Thomas, which calls into question many gun regulations, possibly including the one that Hunter Biden is accused of breaking. So the president says that case is dangerous. Hunter Biden's lawyer says it's great. What's going on here, Bill Evers? Can you tell us something?
Well, a hypocrisy is going on, but that's nothing new in politics. So you've summarized a lot of the situation here. So the Bruin decision by Clarence Thomas gives a guideline that, just as with free speech, you can't do everything. You can't take a megaphone and go on somebody's lawn and start shouting at them. You have to look back to the time when the Second Amendment was passed, and possibly when the 14th Amendment was passed, that had to do with the rights of people to keep and bear arms. And so in those days, if you were a lunatic, if you were a crazy person — we have other euphemisms today, mentally ill people, severe mentally ill people — people could take a gun away from you in those days. If you were drunk and brandishing a firearm, they could take you could and you could be punished, obviously, if you shot somebody or damaged property with a gun when you were drunk. So, but if you were drunk and you used a firearm improperly, they gave you your firearm back once you sobered up. So the question is being a habitual user of narcotic drugs more like severe mental illness, or is it more like being badly drunk? And so most people, I think, would say it's more like being drunk. You be high on drugs. And so this is the problem that the government has. Now, in this particular case that's being tried in Delaware, The presiding judge has already ruled out, for purposes of the trial that's going on right now, this defense. But it's clear, and commentators have even said this on television, even humor columnists have said this, that in an appeal, they are going to turn to this. And I think, actually, it's quite reasonable that they do, because it is more like, you know, being a drunk. And it's also very peculiar to say, you know, you're not a drug addict, or you're not using illegal drugs, whatever. How long does addiction last for? Is it, you know, is it ever, you once become a habitual user for a while, and then does that continue for the rest of your life? There's a lot of conceptual problems here, the way they've phrased this. So they may be subjecting Hunter Biden to punishment for an unconstitutional questionnaire.
Now, this, of course, is distinct from the problem of whether he lied on a federal form.
Yes, but should you be, you know, this is a typical problem. Let's say the FBI does something bad to you, illegal, that it should not be doing. But in the process of that, you lie to them. Okay, should you be punished for that? This is a pretty serious question. I personally do not think that if something that they're doing to you is unconstitutional and you lie back to them, you should be punished for that. How about punishing them for doing the unconstitutional thing to you?
So, Phil, what do you think? Do you think this kind of the condition in which Hunter Biden was with his drug problems, was it more like being mentally ill, or was it more like, you know, being a drunk and then putting your liquor aside?
Yeah. Well, I think Bill is exactly right that there's hypocrisy all over this case. You know, we compare it to some other recent cases. The Biden administration and other Democratic politicians have pursued some pretty aggressive prosecution against people for marijuana use that have filled out the same form, and they may have many months or even years before gone to a marijuana dispensary in states where it's legal. So this was the big challenge. I think it was before the Fifth Circuit recently, is a user who had legally obtained marijuana in their state, but because it wasn't classified as that federally, they had checked the box on the form for purchasing a firearm, and the Fifth Circuit basically threw it out and said, you can't go after someone for this. Now, Hunter Biden, there's a little bit of a difference in the case because it's not marijuana he was using. He was using some very serious, heavy drugs. The videos of him smoking out of crack pipes and doing intense cocaine.
They're so gruesome, gruesome images.
Pretty gruesome. I think that there's still a case to be made. Yes, that may be similar to inebriation, is when you're under the influence of those drugs. Is a different thing from, like permanently being prohibited from buying a firearm. Yet at the same time, I think it's a distinctive point of law that people are trying now to argue for exonerating Hunter Biden for some very heavy drug use in the immediate proximity of filling out this form, whereas those exact same people would enthusiastically cheer the use of prosecution to go after a casual marijuana user on a technicality because their state's law doesn't match the federal law. So again, hypocrisy through and through on every way that these cases are being handled.
Now, it's interesting that both the gun control groups have stayed away from this because they don't want to be attacking Hunter Biden for having had a gun. On the other hand, the gun rights, the gun owner rights groups have been kind of staying away from this because they don't want the Second Amendment to be protecting the child of a major liberal politician. But there are a few, there's a group called the Firearms Policy Center, and they have said, no, this is a Second Amendment matter, and we shouldn't have this sort of form, and we shouldn't be punishing.
Well, apparently,
and they've said this in specifically with related to the marijuana Fifth Circuit case that Phil was talking about.
Apparently, Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida has tweeted with the provocative question: Should we be rooting for Hunter Biden? Which is interesting, but
yes,
you know,
it shows that he has some philosophical sophistication.
Well, at least logical. Yeah. You know, you mentioned this Fifth Circuit case. I was doing a little reading on it. It's pretty fascinating. Goes back to a situation with a guy named Patrick Daniels in April of 2022. He was driving without a license, and so he was pulled over. The officers found a pistol and a semi-automatic rifle along with some marijuana cigarette butts. And so he was convicted. But then the appeals panel at the Fifth Circuit Court overturned his having been found guilty, his conviction, saying that history and tradition may support limits on an intoxicated person's right to carry, but they don't, quote, they don't justify disarming a sober citizen based exclusively on his past drug use, unquote.
Right. That's going to be the defense issue of the Hunter Biden people on appeal. And this is also why the Firearms Policy Coalition defended the defendant in the marijuana case.
Okay, so I'm going to be the odd voice out and ask another question. I mean, really now, to say that it's his past drug use, I mean, if you're genuinely addicted to these hard drugs, there's no such thing as past drug use, especially when he wrote in his own autobiography, that he was in that period a hard user. I mean,
you sound like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous saying that once a drunk, always a drunk.
Yeah. And you go to those meetings. Apparently, and you say, "I'm so and so, and I'm an alcoholic." I mean, you always say that, no matter what your sobriety level may be.
Okay, so what is that? Does that mean Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't believe that any member should be allowed near a firearm?
We don't know the answer to that.
Of course, we don't. But the point is, that's the logic of the case, and it's similar to driving a car in some ways. Okay, so you're driving a car and you're drunk. All right, that's, you know, shouldn't do that. You should be punished for it. Now, you're driving a car and you're not drunk, but yesterday you were drunk.
Yeah.
Should you be allowed to drive a car? I think you should.
I guess. I mean, if you're not an alcoholic, especially.
But who knows? This is also a conceptual issue for libertarians and classical liberals, because we're a little reluctant to have expert or governmental categories imposed on people in a way that subjects them to constrictions, to restraints, to compulsion by the government, whatever. So, you know, the most thoroughgoing argument for this is Thomas Saws, former, now deceased psychiatrist, and he argued that these categories are not really right, and you shouldn't be labeling people in a way that takes away their freedoms.
So, Phil Magnus, Bill Evers, our colleague, has pretty much rebutted my arguments. You want to say more? Why am I on the wrong track, Phil Magnus, when I say that this kind of drug use is just kind of like being in the grip of a long-term thing, and it's ludicrous to say that, you know, one day you're sober, you can fill out the form, and that's fine?
Well, there's an interesting case here, because I think the evidence on Hunter Biden says he's not just a one-time user of crack pipes. This seems to be a recurring thing for him. I mean, we all saw the images that came both off the laptop, his own confessions. It's just a mountain of evidence that this guy has a drug problem. At the same time, I don't think we've seen evidence yet of him smoking his crack pipe and then running out in the front yard and waving his gun around. Would be more analogous to like driving a car and drunk.
And then punish him for that. But don't necessarily take his gun away.
Right. That would be a penalty assigned to the actual commission of the crime, which would be getting wasted on this drug and endangering the public by waving it around. Just as driving a car while intoxicated is endangering the public. That's the reason why there's a crime here. It's a important nuance, I think, that we need to establish. Now, do I think from a personal perspective, Hunter Biden is very much not a poster child for someone who should be collecting firearms. I think that's something that maybe his father and his family members need to talk to him about and say, look, if you're going to do one of these two things, they don't necessarily end in the best outcomes when you bring them together. But at the same time, that's a different area than like a legal judgment that we're making here.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm getting more persuaded. I mean, maybe I could reformulate Bill's case in my own terms. It may be that he shouldn't have guns at that point, but it also may be that to give government authorities the power to make a determination of this type, however accurate the determination may be to give them a tool that will have too much downside and negative consequences.
Right.
I like that argument.
Imagine if the state argued, the government argued, that anyone who's ever been drunk can't have a firearm.
Oof. Yeah, that would be something else. Let's not go there. Okay, enough said on that, but let's talk about the Second Amendment a little further while we are on the subject. Were either of you surprised at the Supreme Court decision unanimously vindicating the National Rifle Association? People on the court voted in favor of the NRA's position who are not friends of the NRA. Wow, what does that mean?
Well, it's interesting in the sense that in a government has long had a prohibition about interfering with the free speech of people that have, just like it's a First Amendment issue. But corollary to that, the courts have developed a doctrine that the government cannot use another party to engage in censorship to violate free speech. And this is essentially what some of the actions in New York were being, New York was sued over this because they were basically putting pressure on other entities to not do business engagements, to not do banking with the NRA, to not carry an insurance policy, things like that, to basically make their life difficult, which is tantamount to regulating speech in a similar way if they did it themselves. They're just getting a third party and almost coercing the third party doing it. I was surprised that it was a unanimous decision. I expected a case like this certainly would get a majority on the current court based on its previous gun rulings. That seemed to be consistent. But the fact that it was unanimous shows that this was a pretty egregious violation of the First Amendment.
But you say so, having a third party become the instrument.
That's commandeering.
Yeah,
called commandeering.
But that has implications then for all
these
social...
They try and do that a lot. So, but that's why it's good that the court was alert to this. And I think the fact that Sotomayor wrote the decision, and it was a very solid decision, very... So libertarians, classical liberals, have long pointed out that the regulatory state can be used for not just sort of narrowly speaking economic issues, but for other things. So in the case, let's take the case of 19th and early 20th century San Francisco and Chinese immigrants who were coming in, and various people felt they were competing, they were taking jobs, they were competing too successfully in the laundry business, on and on and on. So what did they do? Did they say, no Chinese laundry? No, they didn't say that. They said, all laundries have to be made of stone and not wood. If you're carrying a load, you can't carry it on a pole with tubing's balanced. If you're wearing a queue, pigtail, single pigtail, and we ever stop you or put you in jail overnight, we're cutting the queue off for public health reasons. No, they didn't say no Chinese laundries. They didn't say, you know, no working at a wage, that whatever. They go after things via regulation. And that's what was happening here to the National Rifle Association.
But so if the government can't commandeer another party to impose speech limits on the NRA, say, on some non-governmental agency, doesn't that have implications then for these other cases, like the Missouri case that had to do with the Biden administration leaning on Facebook, Twitter,
yes.
X, and so forth?
It's similar, although not exactly the same.
Not exactly, but does that mean that Justice Sotomayor and Jackson will be more sympathetic to those concerns since they have been sympathetic to this one? I wonder.
I'm sure that advocates arguing before the courts will try to... They always try to look at what justices have said in the past and import into their arguments and their briefs things that they think will resonate with those justices, and I'm sure that will happen here. I think you're right, Grant.
Absolutely.
It'll be interesting to see, Phil.
Absolutely. I think there are definite parallels in the modes and strategies that were used by the state to try to regulate the NRA out of existence. There's a similar parallel in the way that, like, Anthony Fauci and some of these other characters at the NIH and CDC tried to induce Facebook and Twitter and all these other social media companies to censor what they call quote-unquote COVID misinformation
right.
and do it on their behalf. So, so that's where the parallel is. I think it is a pleasant surprise that Sotomayor and the justices on the left sided against New York in the NRA case. It might mean that they're at least conducive to hearing that argument more so than we thought in the social media cases. Well, credit it where was, credit is was, due.
It was fun to see Anthony Fauci in front of the Congressional Subcommittee on the pandemic and saying, oh, what, me suggest that we would downplay and use government pressure to downplay the lab leak there? What, I ever said that? this six-foot thing, that just fell from the air. I don't know anything about that.
Was pretty stunning.
I know nothing. Right. Hogan's Heroes. By the way, the producer of Hogan's Heroes, who also produced The Godfather and Walker, Texas Ranger and Cannonball Run, just died. Al Rudy. But anyway, getting back to this Fauci thing. Oh, I never closed any schools. That wasn't me. I didn't do that. It was pretty amazing.
Now, to be really clear, I think that people should be legally free to lie in general and to have patchy, selective, self-serving memories and so forth. But what we're talking about is a person deploying levers of government power, federal power, in a deceptive way, which to me is a whole other ballgame. We're not just talking about a doddering former doctor who can't quite remember. We're talking about somebody who wielded that power.
The latest discovery out of it, he seems to have been involved in conspiring with other people at the NIH to evade freedom of information and record keeping requirements. You have all these emails that came out from Dr. Morins, his 20-year plus right-hand man. I mean, I looked up this guy. He had co-authored something like 80 different papers with Fauci, although Fauci's now saying, I barely knew him. It's kind of like the gist of his testimony.
right. That was actually a high point.
There are clear emails where this guy's saying, I talked to the FOIA lady at NIH. Here's how you get around the request. Fauci's implicated in that. I mean, that's actual criminal behavior that he should be prosecuted over.
Yeah. So Fauci was asked directly about this, and he said, well, I can't recall any instance of me using private emails for public business.
Well, anyway, an easy way.
Wow.
Release his Gmail.
Right. Absolutely. Please do. Okay. Another change of subject. Thinking about younger voters. They and all of us are approaching the 2024 November election, and President Biden has certainly made an effort at making those voters comfortable. Certainly, his serial efforts to forgive student loan debt have got to play well with that constituency on the whole, unless you're that age person who didn't take out student loans and don't really like other people getting their loans forgiven. But still, a lot of college-age, post-college students would love to have their student loan debts forgiven by President Biden. And then this latest thing seems to be of the same character, namely that his Justice Department apparently is suing company-owning Ticketmaster because of they're violating antitrust laws. And Joe Biden wants young people who go to concerts to have cheaper tickets. So what's not to love?
Well, I think there are two issues here at play with Ticketmaster. And the first is most tickets actually at these venues, the concert venues, are actually underpriced. That's why you see a secondary market that is actually selling them at price clearing levels that are significantly higher than the face value. And that's been going on for generations. I mean, the ticket scalper industry is pronounced. And that comes from a marketing tactic. Oftentimes, concert promoters will underprice because they want to pack the house. Sporting event promoters will underprice because they want to pack the house. Then the second issue here is the way that Ticketmaster and most of the ticket industry, as I understand it, operates, is the sticker price is related to what's paid to the band or paid to the sports team or whoever the performer is at the venue. But a lot of the promotional fees and venue hosting fees actually come from these service charges that are attached on here. And the Biden administration is basically saying, well, Ticketmaster, you're to blame for the service charges. You know, we all know this. We pay $40 face value for a ticket, and there's $12.95 tacked on to it as a service charge when you check out with your credit card. Sure, I could have complaints about that, but the reality of the market is most of those service charges are not going to Ticketmaster. They're
right.
actually going to the venue, or they're going to the concert promoter and some of these other auxiliary components of what is essentially making the event happen. Whether you agree with that or not, I mean, you can complain about that all you want. To blame Ticketmaster for something that's largely out of its control seems to be placing their fire in the wrong direction.
Well, if it's out of their control, then when they dispute this regulatory attempt, they'll probably prevail over it. Does that seem right?
That's what seems to be the case.
It,
I mean, it's back
it
to...
It will be after the election.
Yes. Just it'll like be the student loan case.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
The
right
Supreme
after
Court,
the last election.
The Supreme Court is going to push back again on the loan forgiveness.
Right.
He doesn't have congressional authority.
Right.
It's a major policy move. You have to have a statutory basis for it that's stronger than what they have. And so the loan thing is also going to fall just the way it did earlier. Same thing is true here. You can't, in terms of the consumer welfare, in terms of all the rules of antitrust, they're really going after these people just because they're big. Okay. And that's not good enough, really.
Yeah, so, that's disturbing. I mean, what's...
And also, they're saying, well, you know, the ticketing companies have gone into the venue business. They've gone into the secondary or scalping business also. But, you know, so what? There's nothing. And they're also, there's an argument that competitors are not able to get into the business easily because the Ticketmaster company is tied in so closely or directly owns. They're going to make these arguments, but you know what? It's a competitive market, and you wouldn't have the scalping. You wouldn't have the secondary market if the prices were, you know, based on some kind of monopoly extortion. That just on its face, the fact that they're pricing them under what the market will bear, under the market clearing price, shows that you're not getting squeezed by a monopoly position that they somehow hold.
So the action against Ticketmaster is going to fail because it really doesn't have a sound legal or factual basis. And the
it might succeed because they're piling a lot of different stuff on. Yeah. Something might succeed, but anyway,
right.
It looks dubious.
Well, it looks pretty dubious legally, and then the course for giving the student loans looks pretty dubious. And in both cases, President Biden may well be thwarted by courts or by the Supreme Court. However, in both cases, key thing is the younger voter will remember Joe Biden tried to get us cheaper tickets, and he tried to forgive our student loans, and the Republicans wouldn't let him do it for us.
Well, I don't think it's the Republicans that really are standing in the way, although a few of them are talking about it. The really interesting thing is that Biden is possibly stumbling with younger voters.
Right.
And a lot of different theories about that. You know, the age differences, the people get tired of politicians who have been in public life for a long time. He doesn't seem to be particularly easy to talk to by people in the younger generations. He has a lot of problems, so there's some different polling. There's a Harvard poll that says he's not doing that bad with young people, but there are plenty of polls that show he's not doing as well as Democrats have done in the past. So we'll see.
And of course, he's also trying to appeal, presumably, to that same voting demographic in deciding to reclassify cannabis as a Schedule III drug,
right?
in order to reduce criminal penalties.
One.
You know, what's fascinating to me.
Well, it could be a ploy to get Hunter Biden off of future charges, though.
It could be. But you know,
good point, Phil.
Bill Evers, you gave me this article from The Nation. And I took a peek at it. It's pretty fascinating because The Nation is, you know, the great stalwart of the left. And they are pointing out that the reason younger voters are disaffected is because the Biden administration is too pro-Israel in the conflict in Gaza and so forth. And so they think that he's pandering to the youth vote. This is what they say. This is pretty funny. And this is from The Nation. Biden campaign officials seem to reckon if only we can hunt up enough spare income for kids to get high with at concerts, then they'll forget about this damn war and the cowardly nationwide crackdowns on campus protests against it. That's the nation.
Well, the nation is certainly one of the most important left-wing magazines in America. But interestingly enough, its founding editors were classical liberals.
Yeah, right. And, how far they have moved.
Well, yeah.
Well, if I was a young person in the United Kingdom, speaking of young people, I would be rather alarmed at what the Conservatives are proposing to do in the UK, which is Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who has called a new election for Parliament, has announced that he wants to institute compulsory national service for young people. They can do it in the military or they can do it in some other social service settings, but it's going to be compulsory because they need to serve the nation. So younger people in Britain are probably looking pretty askance at the Conservatives. This seems like the kind of thing that people on the left used to promote, compulsory national service.
Well, it's interesting. So I once edited a book for which I wrote a long introduction called National Service Pro and Con. And it was about a similar scheme that was proposed in the United States by Senator Ted Kennedy, by Congressman Pete McCloskey, by a sociologist, military sociologist named Charles Moskos, and a variety of others. And the idea is, it's not the same as a military draft during America, during World War II, during the Vietnam War, where they're selecting people to go into the military and that's it. The idea is a much broader based conscription, a much broader based impressment. You go either into community service, okay, so you're doing some kind of social work, you're picking up litter on the side of the street, you're helping in hospitals for old people, and whatever you're doing some kind of supposed community service. And if you don't want to do that, you go into the military. But you're not only forced to go into the military.
Yeah, well, that's what this
option.
Is.
That's what this is. And that's what these guys like Kennedy and McCloskey and so forth were also proposing 20 years ago in the United States. So, by the way, this is not as bad as just a direct military conscription because it does have this, you know, thing that's somewhat similar to what conscientious objectors are forced to. So the real reason, another interesting feature of this is that this is the only innovation that the Conservative Party is proposing. And this is their bold proposal. By the way, David Cameron also proposed this some years ago. He's a previous Conservative leader. But the point is, they are a kind of withered party right now.
Yep.
They've gone away from their Thatcherite views of a few decades ago. Liz Truss, who was somewhat quite Thatcherite person, had like only a few weeks in the prime ministership.
Right.
And so they have this this weird mosaic of policies, and this is their bold, innovative thing. The labor people have not really attacked it as an idea.
Yep.
They've just said, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You've ruled for a long time, and you're ineffectual, and you should be thrown out. They're not really attacking this. If you read the man in the street interviews that the newspapers in Britain have, interview young people about this, they have mixed opinions. A lot of them are public-spirited and they would like to help people and so forth. On the other hand, some of them say, I don't really want to be told what to do, and the government is not very effective. One of the articles, I think it was in The Spectator, said, it sounds like trying to get, you know, slave labor, unpaid labor for government projects, which is what it really is.
And certainly, voluntary servitude.
I would also think public unions might have a problem with it.
I would think so, yeah.
Yes,
because
yeah.
It could be cutting into them. And already it's clear, this is from articles in the Telegraph and so forth, that the Army is not happy with this.
Yeah.
Because the Army would rather have volunteers, people who are there willingly and
exactly.
want to do this work.
Esprit de corps.
Right. If they have a lot of reluctant soldiers, it's bad for morale. It adds to training costs. It doesn't enhance effectiveness. And so,
which is really the same thing even on the non-military side, because after all, public-spiritedness is a good thing. But can you generate public-spiritedness by coercively compelling people to engage in public service? Doesn't that kind of undercut the very...
breed resentment.
Yeah, it's not public-spiritedness. It's just compliance with coercion.
Yeah.
And that's the fundamental problem. This reminds me, years ago, I just was thinking of this, in the mid-90s, early 90s, I had dinner with Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, a daughter of Robert Kennedy, sister to RFK Jr. She was just about to be elected lieutenant governor of Maryland. And she was telling a group of us at a dinner party that she was really wanting to institute, you know, national service of just this type.
Right, right.
And
she
was
a proponent of that.
Yeah, and
I
was worried about
well.
That then, and I'm worried about it now. And
worried
I,
about it now?
I like Rishi Sunak, you know, compared to alternatives, but boy, I'm worried about Rishi Sunak. I don't think it's going to work for him.
So the other two aspects of the British political situation are, one, Nigel Farage has now leapt back into leading the Reform Party. He's a famous proponent of Brexit. Yeah, and he's a critic of immigration and so forth. And the second additional thing is the Labour Party, its rhetorical extravaganza is that it wants to put a heavy VAT tax on private school tuition. So essentially drive thousands and thousands of private schools out of business.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Bill, you drew my attention to this other weird story out of Indiana about tacos and sandwiches. You want to tell us about that?
Well, all right. So let's say you're in a suburban area just outside the city, and you have kind of a little shopping center, not a fancy one with Macy's in it, but just one story, different outlets, and so, okay. So you could have zoning laws in the town that get very detailed, or you might have an aspect of a lease agreement that is trying to balance different things within it. So it might say they might want to have only one Mexican restaurant or one Latin American restaurant there, or this could be the city, or it could be the owner of the whole block of property that's trying to design what's there. Or they might say we want only one sandwich shop, or we don't want any sandwich shop, or we don't want any taco. So it can be a legal issue. Is a hot dog a sandwich? Is a hamburger a sandwich? Is a taco a sandwich? So there's actually conflicting views, different court cases. But the interesting thing that was pointed out by Ilya Solman in the Volk Conspiracy is that this is tied in to detailed anti-property rights land use regulations.
Exactly.
That they're making these local laws that say, well, in this area, we will only have one sandwich shop, or we don't have any sandwich shop, or we will only have one taco stand, or none, whatever. This is interference. If a landlord wants to do it, okay, that should be up to that landlord. But when the government and the land use planners do this, It's not good, and it leads to distortions of the market as well as violations of property rights.
The owner of the property wants to put in a famous taco, it's called, a famous taco store.
Yeah.
And, you know, all this comes down to, you wonder, we wouldn't have to get in all these, you know, convoluted things if it wasn't regulated in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let people work it out and figure out what they want to buy, and let them own property. And if they can use the property in a way that people want to buy stuff from them, let them do it. I mean, good grief.
But it's funny to see judges making these decisions, which should be custom. It should be what business success they have, how commercially attractive their service or product is. And now they're getting this interference from the bench.
So. I'm sure that defenders of these regulations will say or would say something like, well, voters approved this, you know, previous years, and we decide these things democratically because voters should get what they want, and this is what they wanted. So we've got to enforce it. I just bet that's what they say, which leads me to California, where the voters don't always get to approve the taxes that they're going to have to pay. And there's a new effort to require California voters to approve tax increases. But lo and behold, supporters of so-called democracy like Governor Gavin Newsom don't want the voters to vote on taxes. Have I got that right, or am I exaggerating the case, Bill?
I think you have it right. So California has a very strong referendum plebiscite system going back to the progressive era in the early 20th century. And so we've had previous, most famously Prop 13, but we've had famously a variety of things on taxes and, you know, property taxes and whatever kinds of things. And they either say the status quo is going to prevail, but to overturn the current level of taxes, you have to have a supermajority of some sort. And government officials, of course, don't like this. They want the most flexibility and the most money and the least squawking and the least opportunity to squawk. So what this measure, the proposal says, is if you're going to raise taxes, you have to have a two-thirds majority. And you can't weasel out of it by calling them fees or service charges or something like that. If they, you know, if they smell like a tax, they are a tax. And so the government, the governor is suing to stop. They got all this required signatures. They got it. The election officials have reviewed the signatures and found out they have a sufficient number. And the governor is simply saying the people, the public that would vote, is too ignorant about the sophisticated aspects of taxation. And so they should not be allowed to vote on how much taxation there is. That's their argument.
I thought we believed in no taxation without representation.
Right. Oh, you're just some foolish colonial from 1776.
No, I saw it on the D.C. license plates, actually.
Yeah, well, they have it the opposite. Yeah, they're saying
that the representation.
Right. They're being taxed and not being fully represented. They have some voting rights there. But anyway.
Let's turn finally to a matter of foreign affairs that is worth some discussion. According to the Constitution, treaty relationships between the U.S. and other countries have to be approved by a vote of two-thirds of the Senate. But apparently, President Biden has a new way of establishing these bilateral relationships that avoids the need for Senate approval. What's the deal with that, Bill?
Well, it's not original to President Biden.
Well, no.
We have about 50 of these already. So let's say there's the most famous one from the time of the Bricker Amendment was the Migratory Birds Agreement. You know, so Canada, United States have birds flying back and forth. We have a non-treaty agreement. Now, of course, Franklin Roosevelt tried to lasso us into various things and all subsequent presidents. So there was a senator from Ohio named Bricker, and he said, "No, you have an agreement about coffee or whatever it is, if it's, you know, it should be approved by the Senate. It's a treaty, and things like this should be treaty." So, the president of Kenya came to Washington, D.C., and the United States is trying to expand its footprint and influence in Africa. And we have troops that are currently being driven out by the ruling group in Niger right now. So we have various things that the public generally doesn't even know about, but we have a central command that pertains to Africa and so forth. So we want to have a friendly country there that will work with the United States on whatever strategic initiatives the United States wants to take. And Kenya is a fairly successful African country. It's well-populated. They have semi-good military compared to some of the other countries there. And so it's a naturally ripe for the United States to try to become some kind of ally. Now, normally, we have treaties directly back and forth, let's say with Japan, or we are part of a treaty organization. This is something NATO. Generally, classical liberals are not that fond of treaty organizations because there's both free rider problems with which we see in the case of NATO, where the other members don't contribute their fair share, and plus the danger that we get sucked into the problems of other countries. Let's say Montenegro starts fighting with Serbia or Latvia invades Lithuania, we're like dragged into it. But anyway, at least it's a treaty. At least they've had a public deliberation. They put their names down, the senators, whether they're in favor of this. And so here we have this case where we're getting tied in to Kenya. Now they say, and in the case of these different countries, we don't have a military obligation. We don't have a binding obligation to go to war if Burundi attacks Kenya, or Tanzania attacks, or Sudan, South Sudan attacks Kenya, whatever it is, Somalia, somebody. We don't have a binding military obligation. By the way, Israel's in this position. We don't have a military alliance treaty with Israel. We have the same sort of thing, a strategic agreement arrangement, multiple ones. And that's actually quite troubling. All these military things, these 50-odd things, they should be made into treaties, and some of them wouldn't make it through the Senate. Okay, that's right. That's the American system. That's the Constitution.
You know, interestingly, the U.S. Senate's own website on the subject of treaties has this interesting remark that it recommends and praises the constitutional requirement for Senate approval of treaties, because that means that treaties must overcome political and partisan divisions to gain approval.
Exactly.
Which is a nice point.
There you go.
So let's hope that President Biden and other presidents think a little more narrowly about their prerogatives. That's my thought.
Yes.
I think your thought is right on target, but they're not going to do it because they like the flexibility of them deciding without public scrutiny.
Right.
And without overcoming the convenience that comes with having these alliances. I mean, one of the things on the Kenya situation, they're currently talking about deploying Kenya troops to deal with the problems in Haiti. And it's a way for the United States to sidestep that.
At the behest of the United States.
I'm sure the American taxpayer is in there somewhere.
Oh, no doubt.
With the Haiti situation.
We're probably funding both sides or all sides.
Well, it's like that other case of President Biden is leaning on a third party, the Kenyans, to get them to go in and do what the U.S. wants in Haiti.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
I think that no matter who wins the presidency later this year, that we're going to have to be eagle-eyed about the misuse of executive power and the sidestepping of legislative processes. Our Constitution is a brilliant document, but if the executive has all the powers of the legislature, then the executive's pretty much unlimited, and that's a recipe for disaster.
That's exactly it.
Let's give each of you a chance, if you wish, to make a parting comment on a subject of your choice before we say goodbye to our friends.
Well, you know, we just went through the Trump bookkeeping trial, and I am one of the people who thinks it was a travesty. It was imported a federal elections rule. I don't really favor the federal elections rules, but what the Trump people did in the way of bookkeeping was not a violation of the federal elections rules. And I don't like the whole idea of politicians campaigning, I'm going to get so-and-so if you elect me. This is, you know, attacking the person rather than following the law.
Well, how else was Alvin Bragg going to win his election?
I don't care. It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah. Point well taken, Bill. Anything you want to add in parting, Bill Magnus?
Yeah, I'd say pay attention to Fauci. I don't think this story is over. I think there are many more revelations that are going to be coming. And I think it only gets worse for him from here on out, because as more records come to light, and I say this as someone, as an experienced FOIA person that has tangled directly with Fauci's office on this, as more records come to light, it's very clear that they were hiding some behavior that was not approved under law. And it's going to be harder and harder for him to excuse that away.
Pay attention. And I think that very likely Phil Magnus may have more to say in writing on the subject, which reminds me to invite our friends, of course, as always, to visit our website, independent.org, where we give you a lot of resources, both readily accessible and quite in-depth, to keep track of some of these things. Thank you both, gentlemen, for all you've done for us in this conversation today. Bill Evers, thanks.
Thank you.
And Phil Magnus.
Thank you.
And we invite our friends to come back next time for Independent Outlook. Take care, everybody.